and the delegation, your delegation this morning. We would like to welcome you all after quite a long break, and I know that we've met before during the outreach, the oversight actually, visit to the Northwest members, but with the department, I think it's after quite some time, after a month or so. May we welcome you back to Parliament and the work starting today. As per our program, we are expected today to be receiving responses and also additional information from the department emanating from the first briefing that we held with the, we had with the minister. We all have received copies of the bill. I guess we also have been following the executive process since 2017 up to where we are today. We have, as I indicated in our last meeting, that is the briefing meeting, we did receive, we had advertised for comments, and people did respond. We have about 30 written submissions and about 3 that have requested to do oral submissions. So we're looking forward to next week where we'll be hearing what people are saying about this particular bill. I know that last time we indicated that we do not have the content advisor, which is very important. I think that is a very important person to have, so that the person can help us with the content analysis and clarification there and there. I've since spoken to the acting secretary, and she has promised that we will be getting one. Unfortunately, they said they still advertised, but then they will maybe be able to provide us one, even if it's on an acting position. We have since been allocated also the a permanent legal advisor. Babu Fulelo. I think you don't know him. He may stand up so that you can see him. He will be with us for the duration of the processing of the bill. yeah. Otherwise, I think we all are looking forward to that process. We're hoping that everything will go well. I've received requests. Maybe I need to disclose. For additional time, I've since declined that because of the time challenges, and mainly because they are still going to get time to make verbal presentations if they do wish to do so. So there's no need to extend the advertisement period. Yeah, I thought I should just disclose that. Thank you so much. Without a waste of time, there's no one new here except Babu Fulelo. May we continue then and hand over to the minister for the response. Oh, apologies, sorry. Yes. Peter Paul, can you give us apologies?
Thank you, Chair. I just wish to place on record that apologies have been received from Mr. M.S. Mabika, MP of the NFP. He'll be attending the colloquium of the Portfolio Committee on Environmental Affairs, and Mr. P. Atkinson, MP, CA, will be arriving a bit later in the meeting.
Okay, thank you. Did Memfolo manage to come down? Not yet. Memfolo is around, it's just that because of the disability, she's not, they haven't provided facilities for such, so she hasn't been able to be here. And it's a bit unfair that we're going to start without her when she arrived well in time. No, it's our apology. I know you've been here well on time, just that the facilities could not permit you to be here. But thank you nevertheless for understanding that you've been able to be here. We've already started. May we request the minister then to... He hasn't started with the briefing. Thank you, Minister.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and good morning to the honourable members, the guests, members of the public, the officials of the department. So thank you for this opportunity, Chairperson, to engage the committee further on the Competition Amendment Bill. On the 17th of July, when we outlined the detail in the bill, I recalled that it was exactly 20 years ago when then-President Nelson Mandela signed the Competition Act into law, and he took a bold and forward-looking piece of legislation that was part of the elements of the post-apartheid program, the transformation of the economy and the society, and that it was therefore symbolically significant that on the 100th anniversary of his birth, we were considering, Parliament was considering the Competition Amendment Bill. During the presentation on the 17th of July, I went in some detail through the provisions of the bill, and on conclusion thereof, members of Parliament put some questions to me, and as a result of time, this was a session that the committee had held during the recess, it was not possible to get to the answers, and the chairperson very kindly offered that the committee would, in the first week of the normal business of Parliament, provide an opportunity for both an answer to those questions, but also any further questions that the committee may have. So thank you, Chairperson, for providing that opportunity today. And what I've been asked to do is to start off with replying to some of the questions that were put, thereafter to briefly summarize again, just as a way of refresher, not do a full-on presentation, but summarize again some of the key elements of the bill, and particularly what we're seeking to achieve. And as I then understand it, Chairperson, there will be another round of questions that committee members may then put. So with that as my brief, I'm going to go straight into the questions that were asked on the 17th of July, and seek to provide the committee with some additional information and certainly the rationale, the thinking behind various changes. Honourable Pitinini opened the batting, if it was a cricket metaphor, or he kicked the ball into play, if it's a soccer metaphor, and he started with Section 18A of the bill, which is the section dealing with the national security veto. And Honourable Pikinini said, asked a question. He said, the national security grounds, to what extent do they seek to advance national interest? And he wanted a little bit more of the thinking behind the provision. So, Chairperson, we also had a question from Honourable Mfolo, who asked similarly. She welcomed very strongly Section 18A, but she asked the question whether the provision had teeth, and then she specifically requested that we clarify whether it would apply to foreign spaza shops as an example to get a sense of what was intended with the provision. Honourable Atkinson asked a question that indirectly spoke to 18A without specifically mentioning it, so I'm going to come back separately to Honourable Atkinson's question. If I can then therefore deal with the two questions that were asked on 18A directly. So first, let me start by saying that Section 18A is intended to cover a gap in our law, a gap that in other jurisdictions, in countries elsewhere in the world generally, there are provisions that enable the executive to deal with national security issues as it affects foreign investment, in some cases foreign mergers, but even more generally foreign investment. And in South Africa there's a constitutional responsibility on the state. So in the constitution, the national executive and parliament are responsible for national security. Parliament, of course, carries out its responsibility by making laws, and the national executive carries out its responsibilities by implementing laws and by allocating funds and financing to the implementation That, of course, is also subject to approval by Parliament. Now, in our law, which deals with mergers, that part of the law which deals with mergers, we have two concepts, and it's going to go to the question that Honorable Piccinini asked on national interest. We have two concepts in our law, in our current law. The first concept deals with competition concerns, and the second one with public interest concerns. Now, competition concerns deal with how vigorously firms compete in a market. So when two firms want to merge, when one firm wants to take over another firm, in our law we look at whether that takeover or that merger will reduce the level of competition in the market. And will it do so so significantly as to be against the objectives that they accept? So that's the traditional competition test that our law applies. So take an example. If there are only three retailers in the country, and two of them, say the biggest one wants to buy the second biggest one, then at the end of such a transaction, you will have a highly concentrated market. The concentration levels will be even higher. That means consumers will have less choice, and there are fewer people fighting each other by bringing down prices or improving quality, and therefore it could be against what the Competition Act seeks to do. So that's your traditional competition concern. Our law is interesting in that it introduced in 1998 a concept called public interest. And public interest is not just the traditional competition issue, it's what is the impact of a merger on employment? Will it reduce the total number of jobs in the affected firms? What's the impact on small business and BEE players, what the Act calls historically disadvantaged persons? And it also looks at the impact on South Africa's ability to compete internationally and the impact on regions or industries. So that would be called public interest. National security is a distinct and different concept. It doesn't deal specifically in the first instance with the impact of small business or employment. It deals really with essentially the security of the state and the ability of the state to ensure that the security of citizens are protected. We don't have a provision in our law that would enable us to do so. And in a rule of law dispensation and in a constitutional democracy like ours, if you don't have a legal provision to deal with something, your ability as the executive to carry it out is limited. So we have to, as it were, address that gap in the law. Other countries have done so. Countries that are frequently cited as examples of legal systems that investors and others are familiar with have, in many cases, provisions that are more intrusive, that are, if you like, harsher, more demanding, more extensive than the provisions we bring to law. The United States, for example, has a Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. It's called CFIUS. And it looks at any foreign merger. If a foreign firm wants to buy an American firm, they have a whole set of criteria that they apply, and then they make recommendations to the President of the United States, and the President then either declines the merger or approves the merger. In jurisdictions like Canada, and Australia, they set out very detailed provisions in their statutes. In the case of Australia, for example, a lot of their criteria is much more extensive than what we're proposing. And interestingly, just given recent debates, Australia focuses quite a lot of attention on foreign ownership of land. In the case of Canada, they have very extensive provisions, and their provisions go beyond a narrow focus on national security. They would look at things like the national heritage of Canada. If you buy, if you seek to buy a company that in some or other way is associated with the national heritage of Canada, that can be a grounds for vetoing a provision or a merger. Now, Honorable Piccinini asked whether the national security will advance national interest, and is it the same as national interest? And in answer to the first question, yes, it will advance national interest. And in answer to the second question, no, it's not quite the same. National interest is much broader than national security. So national interest would deal with things like public interest. Employment would be part of national interest. It may deal with things like South Africa's cultural heritage and so on. But we've limited in the bill the provision only to national security. In our view, it's the most glaring gap, and we should simply seek to address that. Now, I mentioned three countries, but it's not to say that it's only those three countries that have provisions like this. The European Union, for example, provides member states with grounds to object to a merger on national security grounds. And in other jurisdictions, for example, the People's Republic of China and others, give their national executive much deeper powers to deal with mergers and, in fact, any foreign ownership in the economy. In our case, we've gone for a relatively focused, fairly narrow set of provisions, and we've provided in the bill that the president must identify the sectors and products that are covered by the definition of national security. But we've also given in the bill guidelines to the president. So the president would have to take into account, in saying what sectors are involved, a list of criteria that Parliament would have approved. So it constrains, in the South African case, more significantly than it does in many other cases. And by way of example, in the American case, not only do they have a set of criteria in their guidelines that apply to CFIUS, but they also say such other factors as the president or the committee determined to be appropriate. The committee is this committee called CFIUS. So we've gone a different route. We've tried to say a little bit more clearly and not given very broad any other matter provisions. And it then brings me to the question that Honorable Mfolo asked, whether a provision like this would affect foreign ownership, for example, in spaza shops. And the answer is, Honorable Mfolo, that these provisions are not intended to deal with such small transactions. It's not to say that there may not be merit in looking at that, but in merger regimes, you're looking for quite significant transactions. And so this would only apply to quite large mergers, and what we've done is we've taken into account current provisions in the Competition Act that indicates what kind of mergers must be notified to the Competition Commission, what the law calls intermediate or large mergers. So typically it would be a merger where the combined asset value or turnover is greater than 600 million rand, or the company that is being bought over has a turnover greater than 100 million rand. So it's not intended to cover everything in a competition law. There could be an argument that one needs a general law. Some countries have a general law dealing with foreign investment, and they deal with these kind of things in a general law. And our objective here is much narrower. We seek only to cover relatively large transactions and only national security. So it's not a national interest clause, Honorable Piccinini. We did think last year whether we should introduce a national interest veto, and when we weighed it up carefully, I listened to the arguments in favor of it, I listened to the arguments against it, and on balance, the bill that we prepared for public comment last year, I made the point in the explanatory note that we had not gone that route. Some countries go that route, but on balance, we felt our system is a useful system. It's got a lot of checks and balances in them. They allow the executive to play a role on things like employment and small business development, as we've shown with the big mergers, Coca-Cola, AB InBev and others. But they give the decision-making powers on some of those issues to the regulators. I must acknowledge that there's been a point of view that we the executive should in fact have that veto, and there is a credible argument on it, but as with every argument, you weigh up the advantages and disadvantages, and we felt our current system is a very useful way of ensuring that you have executive input, but decision-making powers on ordinary public interest ultimately would be by the regulator. National security, though, is different. National security does not fall within the remit of the competition authority. So you can't give a power like this. They're not trained to deal with issues of national security. These are typically, in every society, the domain of cabinet and the president. And so we've provided in the bill an arrangement where the president nominates the committee that deals with national security. And interestingly, we haven't prescribed any particular composition. In normally, in a provision like this, at least the minister responsible for the act would be an automatic member of the committee. But again, when we looked at it, we felt that it's appropriate to give the president a relatively free hand to constitute that committee. In the constitution, it's the president that assigns responsibilities to members of the executive, and therefore fitting into the constitutional architecture structure, we put forward the proposal that is in the bill. I then come to the question that Honourable Atkinson asked, and Honourable Atkinson raised the issue. Honourable Atkinson appreciated that we were filling significant gaps in the law. But he raised the issue, how do the changes taken as a whole and the components of them relate to foreign investment? Would they serve to support the increase in levels of investment, of foreign investment in the economy? And What were our reflections on this? And yeah, what we did was we were particularly keen when we drafted the bill to look at the way in which we can encourage increased investment in the economy, because investment is really a significant driver of growth. If you think about it, you can get lots of other things right, but if you don't actually have fresh capital that enters your market, your economy, you're not going to grow. So what we did was, we looked at the number of different parts of the bill, of the act. The first thing was, if one wants to bring in fresh capital from domestic players or from foreign players, what do they see as structural challenges? Some structural challenges fall outside the Competition Act. So those have to be addressed. And competition policy, of course, can't do everything. So within the remit of competition policy, what are the potential challenges? And one of the key challenges we find when we speak to foreign investors is that they would say the South African economy is highly concentrated, that the consequence of that concentration is that the incumbents, the companies that are currently the dominant players in the economy, have an advantage that means any new competitor that comes in will not be able for many, many years to make a profit because they don't have the advantages of incumbency, and therefore they are reluctant to come in. It came with a large possible investment a few years ago where we were keen to encourage a new player, and they were very interested. And ultimately, they said, the dominant player is too entrenched in the market. So what we did was, the provisions in Section 43 dealing with market inquiries will look at the challenge of economic concentration. And it's a complex challenge, not an easy thing. You can't just simply prohibit it, or on the other hand, just leave it unchanged. And if we get the efforts to promote greater deconcentration in the economy right, it opens space for new players. So that's one area in the bill that we've attempted to speak to measures that can encourage new entrants in the market. In fact, some of the new entrants, of course, can be foreign investors. The second area that we looked at is the abuse of dominance, where you have dominant firms, and not only do they have incumbency advantage, in other words, not only are they already there, so they've got the advantage of being the existing player, but some of them abuse their position to prevent new entrants from coming in. So in a number of areas, you will see in Section 8 and to some extent in Section 9, of the bill, the act, we've introduced changes that would limit the extent to which an incumbent would be the dominant firm currently, in which they can use their market power to exclude anyone else. The third area that we've dealt with is in looking at national security, Section 18A. We've narrowed national security, or we've narrowed the executive veto, if you like, just to national security. And we've provided a relatively short period, 60 days, within which that work would be typically completed. And we've provided that the president would have to proactively gazette the sectors where such transactions would be involved. Say, for example, armaments. Then you know if you're in the armaments industry, you'll have to go through that process. So foreign investors would have greater certainty about what is the regulatory regime in place. Of course, while we want to encourage foreign investment, it's quite critical. It brings lots of potential gains to the economy. We also want to, at the same time, bring in let's call it small business capital. You want to create opportunities for black South Africans, young people, women, people with disabilities, rural entrepreneurs, in rural enterprises. You want opportunity for all of them. So in a way, in a competition law, we would not develop a customized or bespoke provision dealing with foreign investment, but you'd look to see how can you promote investment. Competition is essentially about protecting a process in which the players that are already in the market can't conduct themselves in such a way that they make it difficult for anyone else to come in. So if you think about what competition law is about, it's protecting the market from a dominant player capturing the market. So let's call it market capture, given that we've spoken in the past about state capture. So competition law all over the world is about avoiding, preventing market capture. And it arose in the United States where these big companies are called trusts, or used to be called trusts. And so you read in the literature about what is called antitrust legislation. Moving then to another part of Honorable Atkinson's question on investment. Commentators like the IMF, World Bank, and the OECD, when they look at the structure of the South African economy, one of the areas that they've repeatedly pointed to is what they call excessive product market concentration. In other words, that our economy is just so concentrated that it's not going to create the traction, the ability, in fact, for growth levels to go up significantly. And some of it has quite a significant impact. For example, in the 2018 report in South Africa, the World Bank estimated that markups above normal profits account for up to 10% of GDP in South Africa. Now, that's quite a significant one. And they said if by 2030 we could halve these markups, these above normal markups, it could lead to a 10% increase in investment. So there's economists would do modeling that shows that if you can open up, if you can create more space, if you create more dynamism, you also attract new investment. Honorable Mfulu then also asked another question, and it's a question dealt with cartels and criminalization. And she asked whether the provisions dealing with criminalization would affect individual directors. And the answer is yes. That when a firm is found guilty of collusion, there are two remedies that the law prescribes. The one remedy is the remedy that affects the firm directly. So that would be either a penalty, or it could even be more intrusive if it's so warranted. And the other penalty is against individual directors of the firm, managers of the firm, who are responsible for the collusion. And they could, of course, get up to 10 years in jail. The next question that was put is, Honorable Mfulu asked whether the provisions that we've put in place would allow for new players to enter the mining sector, as an example. And the answer is clearly in a law of general application, this is not a sector law. It covers the economy as a whole. The intention is that across the economy, it must allow for new players to come in and smaller players to come in. So a big focus of the law, honorable members will see many more references to small and medium enterprises and to the entry of black South Africans into the economy. Whether in a particular sector the competition authorities will find that a concentrated market serves to exclude small players is something that the evidence must lead us to. Let me use an example. And it's an example that I'm going to give. Let's take Facebook as an example. Facebook has a set of technologies that underlie this product. Now, if the technology belongs to Facebook, and if as a result of that, let's say in this instance it was an exclusive technology, which it's not completely because others can come into the space, but if it was, then Facebook would have, it'd be in a concentrated market. But the reason it's in a concentrated market is because of the technology. The competition authorities may well say there's nothing that they should do about this because it's a proprietary technology. Or if I use an example of, say, this gadget, which is a pointer. If there's only two companies producing this, so it's a high level of concentration, but the capital cost to set up a factory like this is enormously high, and you need to produce a certain minimum number of these pointers to be competitive. The competition authorities may say, we can see it's a concentrated market, but it's not warranted that we should do anything, because if we force more players to come in, each will produce fewer of this, which would shoot the price up very high. So if a particular product market relies on what economists call economies of scale, meaning that you must produce a lot of something to be able to bring the price down, then you may say there's an economic logic to it. Society benefits from it. But if, on the other hand, the producers of bottled water, if there's only two producers of bottled water, and they are in a concentrated market, and the competition authorities find that there is space for others to come in, that the fact that the market is concentrated means small businesses are not coming in, black South Africans are not gaining entry into the market, the dominant players use the fact that they're already there to essentially maintain control of that market, then the competition authorities, in terms of the bill, would have very significant powers. They would be able to put remedies and actions up that would enable that market to be deconcentrated. So I've given these examples to show that it's a complex thing, because not all concentration can always be avoided. Some of them are unavoidable because they help us to achieve other goals. So therefore, it's written as carefully as it has been written. Honorable Mfulu also asked us questions whether the information that we have on economic concentration speak to foreign ownership and race. And the answer is no, not for the information as a whole, but when we look at sectors, we can begin to see that in some cases. So I'll use the example of the LPG, the Liquid Petroleum Gas Report, which we tabled in Parliament and which I understand members of the committee have copies of. When the Competition Commission did a market inquiry there, they found that the top four players were absolutely dominant in LPG. Is this the gas that you use at home to just cook with and so on? And they found further that all of the top four players were foreign owned. And they found further that there were black players in that sector, but the practices in that sector were such that the black players found that they couldn't run their businesses profitably. So there they gave us an insight into foreign ownership and the demographics of the sector. Now, when that report came out, the competition authorities had no power to do anything. It's just they can say to us, they recommend that we engage the big players, they recommend that the Minister of Energy reviews the law and takes it to Parliament, whatever the detail is. What's different in the bill is it provides the competition authorities with the tools to do something about the problem that they've identified. Moving on then to the question that Honourable Mfula asked, which is the Committee on National Security. I've answered that, but Honourable Mfula also asked, does the committee have teeth? And the answer is yes, in the sense that the committee can prohibit a transaction. They can say, no, no, that merger can't go ahead. Or they can put conditions to a merger. But they are limited only to national security. And they're limited only to the sectors that the president has specifically identified by a notice in the Gazette. And they're limited only for larger transactions as set out by the turnover thresholds that is in the bill or in the Act. Honourable Kiani raised two really interesting questions. The first question is, he said that language in the drafting of bills matter enormously, and that in looking at language, have we thought of the problems of ambiguity? And are we sure that the nomenclature, the language used, is as clear as we could be so? And I thought it was a particularly sharp question, because competition law is one of the most complex pieces of law that we have. It is perhaps the best interface of law and economics of any piece of legislation. Tax law is complex, technically complex, but competition law goes to, it embeds within it economic concepts. And so when you sit in a merger hearing, you see that the economists, you get the lawyers who they argue the legal points, then the economists come and they give expert witness, expert evidence on the economics of a transaction. So we've tried, through increasing the number of definitions, Honourable Kiani, to make it a bit clearer what we mean. For example, just to give one illustration, the law as it currently stands has got the concept of predatory pricing. Predatory pricing is when you're a big player, you're a dominant firm, and you act in such a way, you bring your prices quickly down because a new entrant comes in, you knock them out because the prices are so low, as soon as they're out, you raise your prices. Now, the concept is there, but you won't find it written like that anyway. You've got it, it's implied. So we've made it clearer in the bill by bringing it out. I think we've tried as far as we can to make the language as simple as we can, but if we make it too simple, the problem is the courts will not have the necessary guidance from Parliament on complex issues. So we've tried to find a balance between simplicity of language, but also the nuances that the courts would need to have available to them. Honourable Kiani also asked a second question, which is, he welcomed what he saw as the inclusivity drive of the bill, and he said, how do we ensure that, in fact, smaller players can use the space that opens up? That if we deal with a matter of dominant firms, will it result in small players taking up the space? And the answer is that obviously the Act or the bill can't guarantee outcomes. It guarantees processes, and it gives competition authorities tools. So what we've done is we've written into the bill provisions that specifically puts the test on what, for example, price discrimination, what impact price discrimination has on smaller players. So instead of formulating it generally and implying that it also covers small players, we've now explicitly said in that provision, Section 9, that we need to look at the impact on small players. So it's an attempt to do two things. On the one hand, to not make the law too onerous on large firms by narrowing the application, in this case, to small business, and secondly, by giving the authorities a mandate to deal specifically with small firms. So Parliament would then be able to hold the executive to account to say, in the law, it specifically says under price discrimination that you've got to look at the impact that price discrimination has on the ability of smaller players to participate in the market. Have you achieved that? So that's how we've tried to deal with the challenge, Honourable Kleani, that you've put to us. Jefferson, those were the substantive questions. There were a few points around procedure and information that also came up, but I hope I've been able to capture all of the questions that were put in the first round of the session on the 17th of July. Chair, taking your invitation to just very briefly, and I'm going to do it very briefly, summarize again the main changes to the bill. What we're trying to do, not running through things. The full presentation has been loaded if it's helpful, but I'm not intending to do that.
Just before you continue, I just want to find out from members if there are any follow-ups to the responses from the minister. If there are any follow-up, Dr.
Kyle? Sure, there were a number of questions on the bill, but I realised I wasn't present at that.
No, I'm calling for a follow-up.
Okay. As long as there's an opportunity.
Okay, we'll come to that. Let's allow the minister now to give us just a refresher on whatever that, on what he gave us on the 17th. And then we can then ask questions based on what you'll be presenting. Over to you, Minister. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I'm going to resist the temptation to take the committee through the full presentation of last time. I'm sure the committee would be thankful of being spared that very detailed treatment. And really just highlight, because I think in the engagement with the committee, there's also an opportunity to lift out what we're trying to do. But essentially, why are we making the changes to the bill? It's to open up the economy, to recognize that while the competition authorities have done a lot in the last 20 years, there's a gap between the aims of the Act and the powers given to the regulators in the Act. So, as an example, if I point the committee to the preamble to the Competition Act, the current Act, it says the people of South Africa recognize that apartheid and other discriminatory laws and practices of the past resulted in excessive concentration of ownership and control within the national economy. And then it goes on and it says, inadequate restraints against anti-competitive trade practices. And then it says, and unjust restrictions on full and free participation in the economy by all South Africans. It then says that the economy must be open to greater ownership by a greater number of South Africans. And it proceeds. Now some of these things, like for example, restraints against anti-competitive trade practices. If one goes to Section 4, 5, 8, and 9 of the Competition Act, you will find quite clear provisions there. It's the operational part of it. But if you look at economic concentration, you'll find that it's in the preamble, but it's not in the operational side. So part of what we're seeking to do is to open up the economy by providing that connection. But in the preamble, it also talks about removing restrictions and enabling full and free participation in the economy by all South Africans. And in that sense, we've specifically focused on a gap. And a gap is, if you look at the economy as a whole, we're not getting enough black South Africans starting their own enterprises. The entirety of the BEE debate up to now has been what percentage of shares must be set aside in existing companies for black shareholders. Now, there's value in that, but you don't create new wealth through simply a change in the composition of ownership by saying 10% or 20% is set aside. It has a good redistribution effect, but if you're seeking to grow an economy, then you've got to bring in more enterprises. And the bill is seeking very strongly and very clearly to do that. The third area is we've focused quite a bit of time over the last 8 years on public interest issues in the competition law. And based on our experience, there's some refinements that we seek to make to deal with unintended consequences, gaps, lacuna in the act, just little gaps that there are. And the changes, therefore, in the Act are in four big areas. They're in the actions that are prohibited, where firms are not entitled to do certain things. They're in the area of mergers. They're in the area of market inquiries and economic concentration. And they're finally in the area of institutional changes, ways of refining the powers, constraints, responsibilities, mandate of the various institutions referred to in the Act. And in prohibited practices, which is the first of the four that I spoke of, that's the one that deal with things like abuse of dominance, what committee members would have seen in particular in Section 8 of the Act. It deals with price discrimination, which is Section 9, with exemptions, and I'm going to come back to exemptions in a moment, penalties, what happens if you're in breach of the law, and the issuing of guidelines to the market. Those are the main areas. In each of these, I'm happy to talk a little bit more on what we're seeking to do, but that's essentially, if one wants to get a big picture sense of the first area. In mergers, there are three sets of changes we're proposing in mergers. The first one is how the commission and tribunal deals with mergers, the kind of criteria and considerations that are applied. The second one is the one we've covered now with the question that Honourable Pikinini and Fuller had asked on Section 18A, the national security issues. And the third one is the process of appeals on tribunal decisions. Market inquiries is the next big area, and in the presentation we go into all the detail, but essentially what it does, it says if you're trying to deal with the structure of a market, not the behavior of a company, but does the structure help to open up the economy? Then the best way to do it is to be led by evidence. So create an inquiry. Give all parties a chance to put their facts before the inquiry. Set out in the law the criteria that the inquiry must apply and the procedures it must follow. And then give the inquiry the power to make some decisions. And give the affected parties the right to appeal those decisions. So that's essentially the market inquiries. And then finally, dealing with the institutional changes, there's a number of changes that go to the role of the competition authorities, the refinement of the responsibilities of deputy commissioners and market inquiries, arrangements around making the competition tribunal work more efficient, changes to bring the constitutional amendments of a number of years ago to ensure that the Act is aligned to those constitutional changes dealing with the powers of the Competition Appeal Court. So Chairperson, that's just a very, very quick run through. As I say, the copy of the presentation is here, and if in the course of the next session, the committee would find it useful that I go to particular slides and elaborate a little bit, I would be available and in your hands. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Minister, for that brief recap of what you presented to us. I think what we need to understand is that this is going to be quite a process, especially after the submissions, after looking at the submissions, both oral and written. The committee will have ample time to engage with those submissions, and will, from time to time, where we feel we need the minister to come and clarify, we will call on the minister to come back to us to clarify on some of these issues. This is exactly what happened in the Trade and Industry Chamber at NEDLAC level, where after submission of the bill, there were interactions at the NEDLAC level. A report was written, and after that final submission, they then submitted also to myself to say these are the processes that they went through, and the final outcome was then submitted to the executive for finalization before it was tabled to Parliament. So we expecting that the parliamentary process also is going to be as open as that. So some of the people who had an opportunity to present there will obviously take a second bite, you know, try their luck in putting some of the issues that they were not successful with at that level. So it's upon us to really engage thoroughly on this particular bill. So if there are questions that the members had forgotten to talk about or to raise, or that arose after we had that engagement with the minister, may we please ask the question? May we ask? Members, this is the opportunity. Dr. Kaido.
Thanks, Chair. Thanks, Minister, for the presentation. I have two overriding concerns and questions, firstly to do with Section 80A on national security. Now, my understanding was that in the previous version of the bill, these issues weren't brought into play, that there was an about term. So I wanted to ask you, what was the advice of the advisory panel that you announced, I think it was in your budget speech 2 years ago, what was the advice of the advisory panel on including these national security provisions? My understanding was that the Department too advised against the provisions as they've been expressed in the latest iteration of the bill. And then I had a particular question around the examples you chose of the US, Canada, and Australia, because my understanding is that those jurisdictions do have a vetting system and a vetting process, but that this is all done by independent bodies. But what we are proposing in this legislation is to basically hand that power, to relinquish that power, to give it to the President, who has huge scope to interpret national security in whatever way the President likes. So I wanted to know whether you had discussions around immunizing this against political manipulation in any way, and what sort of considerations were given to making this as independent as possible. Secondly, also on the same broad theme of political interference and possible manipulation, I mean, to me it seems as if this bill does give the Minister of Economic Development significantly greater powers in a whole range of fields. I mean, essentially allowing the Minister to intervene in cross-border transactions, appeal against decisions by the Competition Tribunal, call for or halt market inquiries, issue exemptions from the Competition Act. What is the rationale for increasing ministerial intervention through this legislation? And then some very specific issues, which I just wanted to flag, I won't go into any great detail. A concern around market inquiries and the proposed binding nature of these findings. The penalty regime, why has there been the removal of the orange card, and what is the possible, what are the possible unintended consequences of that in terms of potentially stifling dynamic competition by efficient large firms? I'm very concerned about Section 9, discrimination by a dominant firm. This amendment, I think, may be inconsistent with the broader objective of assisting in growing small and medium business enterprises. Section 8, the definition of excessive pricing, I think, is especially problematic. 8.3. Anyway, those are just things that I wanted to flag. We can obviously discuss them in greater detail as this process unfolds, but my real questions are around Section 18A and also the broader ministerial powers of intervention. Thank you.
Thank you, Minister. I am going to allow you to, because I know that you've dealt with it through some other submissions that you've received. May I get further questions, if there are any other questions or concerns after engagement perhaps with others? Okay, Minister, may you then respond to this one?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I should say on a light-hearted note that I'm very worried that there are no other questions. You know, in any market, when there's a mismatch between supply and demand, you should be worried. But thank you very much for the questions. Let me start with Section 18A, which Honourable Cardo says is really the most significant concern. And my hope is that if we can allay the concerns and fears that Honourable Cardo may have, that he may be a strong champion of the Competition Amendment Bill and would be, be issuing a statement in support of our I'm sure that he is beginning to draft it, but he wants to first hear whether I can persuade him on these matters. On a serious note, I think let me first start with the easy part, which is Section 18A was not in the original bill that we published last year. And Section 18A was not addressed by the panel at all in its work that led to the formulation of the bill last year. There's been a bit of a misunderstanding in the public discourse, so let me bring that into the discussion and clarify something that I think has been a misunderstanding by some of the journalists, which may have some background to the question. In the bill that was published last year, we considered whether we should introduce a executive veto essentially on public interest. Should the Minister of Economic Development have the power to say that if a merger has a negative effect on employment, then that merger should be prohibited? And there were two points of view. There was one point of view in favor of it, and there was one point of view against it. And I heard both points of view. It was my judgment call, not the advice by the department, it was my judgment call, which I then worked through with my cabinet colleagues subsequently, that we should retain the current architecture of the Competition Act. That we should provide that the competition authorities would have the final say on the matter. And the argument for it, we then set out in a few paragraphs in the note that was published with the bill last year in December. And in those arguments, we identified on balance why we believed it would be appropriate to retain the existing system. Now, that had nothing to do with national security. That was an executive veto over public interest. What we're talking about now is national security, which is conceptually a different matter. And in the course of discussions in NEDLAC, the issue of national security came up. One of the parties raised the issue. We looked at it carefully. We reviewed the research and information that was available to government. And based on that, we felt it appropriate to include in the bill that is submitted to Parliament a provision on national security. So I think I wanted to clarify that misunderstanding that may... So in the Government Gazette of last year, on page 22, we drew attention to say, at present, there is insufficient alignment of competition-related processes and decisions with other public policies, programs, and interests, and with the policies that voters embrace through the democratic process. We then went on and said this juncture should be addressed. One option would be to centralize the decision-making processes in the executive, where there is a confluence of all related matters. And this could be achieved by providing the responsible minister with a greater role in the decision-making process, by, for example, providing the minister with the right to review merger decisions on specified grounds, such as the impact it would have on employment, small business, and upon business or potential business that are owned or controlled by historically disadvantaged persons. And then it says there is international precedent for providing the executive with an effective veto power over mergers. This approach has a number of problems. And then we identified the problems with those. And we said the second and preferred option is to follow the underlying philosophy of the existing Act and keep the decision-making processes within the Commission, Tribunal and CAC, but provide the responsible minister with more effective means of participating in competition-related inquiries, investigations and adjudicative processes. This option allows the executive to engage in the decision-making process, ensure the consideration of policy-related matters, enables better integration of policies across the state, and provide the necessary connection between concerns of the electorate and the work of the competition authorities. This promotes transparency and a rational consideration of all related matters. So that's how we put it out then. That was what I published. So having clarified that these are two completely different species, that dealt with public interest, this deals with national security. The question could be asked, why deal with national security now, and why not put it in the original bill? It was not part of what the panel had recommended, either pro ante. They didn't look at national security as an area of concern. And frankly, there are two roads the executive could follow. It could do a new law that deals only with national security. beyond competition. In other words, the current provision deals with a merger, but a new law could be even larger than it. It can look at what is called greenfield investment. So the American system, for example, would be broader than our system. It would give the American authorities greater power to deal with matters that are not purely mergers. We've taken the view that it's appropriate, given everything that we do, that we make the minimum necessary changes to enable the executive to carry out its constitutional responsibilities on national security, and that we shouldn't at this point widen it too much. That this could provide us with a very useful experience. If this is sufficient, we don't need to go further. If there are gaps, we can come back to Parliament in due course and deal with it. The second part of what Honorable Cardo raised was the U.S., Canadian, and Australian system and the vetting system. In the case of the United States, it's in fact a committee that is established called CFIUS. It's made up of what they call the Department of the Treasury that chairs it, the Department of Justice, Homeland Security, Commerce, Defense, Department of State, Department of Energy, the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, and the Office of Science and Technology Policy. So the equivalent, you can see the equivalent. And then they have people who observe and participate in CFIUS's activities where appropriate. It would be your Office of Management and Budget, your Council of Economic Advisers, which is the President's Council, the National Security Council, the National Economic Council, and the Homeland Security Council. And the Director of National Intelligence and the Secretary of Labor are non-voting ex officio members. So it's essentially a committee of the executive in the United States. But what's interesting there is ultimately the president makes the decision. So what we've done here is instead of letting the president make the decision, the proposal in the bill is the committee makes the decision. And it's a committee made up of members of cabinet and members of senior officials in the state. In the case of Australia, the committee is effectively chaired by what we would call the Minister of Finance. So it's their treasurer. And the reason why this is done is one wants to ensure that you have, in many parts of your law, you want to have an arm's length arrangement between the decision makers on certain matters and the policy makers. So we do that, for example, with public interest. We've kept the system that regulators make that decision. But national security is a very different kettle of fish. That is a matter that the executive in every country does not delegate to an outside body. It's ultimately the one area that an executive, doesn't matter which country it is, retains as its responsibility. And in our case, it is a constitutionally defined responsibility of the national executive. So it would probably be unconstitutional to delegate that power when the Constitution doesn't provide for the executive to delegate that power. However, we try to deal with the potential of political manipulation. Look, I think it's a fair question. And given the history we've gone through, it's important that we develop laws that see us through sunshine and rain. And we've tried to give it a fair bit of thought. And what we've put forward is a construct under Section 18A. And it says, number one, that this doesn't become a decision ultimately of the president. The president appoints the members of the committee because the president in our constitution assigns responsibilities to the executive. The executive constitutionally is responsible for national security, so it's appropriate the president does that. Having done that, the president then stands back and leaves it to the committee. We could have gone the American route and say the committee makes a recommendation to the president, but we felt it's more likely if you have a committee drawn from different portfolios that you'd be able to bring in the skill and the expertise that resides all over, and to the extent that there may be a concern about concentration of power, that one avoids that. The second thing we've done is the law explicitly provides the guidance that the president must follow. So the president does not have a free hand in defining the sectors and products that are covered. The president must take into account the specific elements that Parliament would have approved. And so that constrains the exercise of power because it has to fit in with the criteria that is in the law. The third thing that we've attempted to do is to ensure that the time frames are known. So this may not be an issue of political manipulation, but it is a concern that any investor would have. And we've specified the period. We've indicated that the competition authorities would not make a decision that until this committee has considered the matter, but there's nothing to stop the competition authorities from beginning their own work. Obviously, the amount of resources they will invest will be based on whether they believe that there are genuine prospects of security concerns resulting in a veto. So it's an attempt to balance it all in the manner in which the law has been, or the draft law has been written. And at the end of the day, because we believe that Parliament should play a role, we've also provided in the bill that once the committee has made a decision, that decision, whether it is to prohibit, to approve, or to approve with conditions, that decision must be published in a gazette. And that report containing the decision must be tabled in Parliament. So we can make the argument why on matters of national security, it should not be tabled in Parliament. But because one wants to find a balance between the legitimate interests of the state on national security and the need for transparency and accountability so that these things balance each other out, we've put that provision in, and it's not a provision that I think one would generally find in legislation elsewhere in the world. So whilst I would acknowledge that nothing in life is guaranteed, I think in the provisions of the bill, there's been a serious attempt to try to find a balanced approach, to recognize that the state has legitimate national security concerns and interests, that the executive has a constitutional responsibility in that regard, that it must carry it out in as expeditious a time frame as possible, and that ultimately its reports must be known publicly. If it makes a decision, that decision should be known publicly. So I hope, Honourable Carter, that goes some way towards helping to solicit that press release in support of the Competition Amendment Bill. The second area that Honourable Carter raises is the role of the cabinet member responsible for competition, in this case the Minister of Economic Development. And Honourable Cardo raised four examples to say, you know, this does signal an increase in the power and the responsibility of the minister. Why? Is it warranted? And of the four, on the first one, cross-border transactions, the Minister of Economic Development does not have any power in Lebowa. The cabinet, he's a member of cabinet, obviously, but the president constitutes that committee. If the president chooses to constitute that committee only of cabinet members from the security cluster, that's the prerogative of the president. If the president seeks to do it from sector ministers in the sectors that are defined, let's say surveillance equipment, then perhaps the Minister of Telecoms, then that's the prerogative of the President. So the Minister of Economic Development is not written into the bill. And I make this point in a light-hearted manner. It's unusual for the minister responsible for a bill not to be written in, and I specifically thought it's appropriate, and I made that advice to cabinet, and cabinet accepted that advice. The second area is on market inquiries. Now, currently the law already provides that the minister may request the competition authorities to convene a market inquiry. What we've done now is we've changed the focus of the market inquiry to deal with something that is much more an explicit public interest issue, not just the residual competition issues of before, and that's the issue of economic concentration. And these are matters that the public have views on. They're matters, no doubt, that will come up next year in an interesting process that is known as an election campaign. People will have points of view. They'll vote for parties this way or that way or the other way on these kind of things. That's what a democracy is about. And in that process, whichever party wins will have views on the matter. And if those views require that there be a market inquiry in a particular sector, they should be entitled to call for it. And the agent through which they do it is whoever is the cabinet minister responsible. Now what we've done, and this is really interesting, we haven't given the executive the power to make the decisions on deconcentration. We've left that to be an evidence-led process run by the regulator. And if we look at the provisions in the bill, committee members will probably be surprised at how cautiously it's written, how many checks and balances are put in place. For example, we do something called a proportionality test, where we say that the market inquiry can't make a decision on an action that is disproportionate to the problem it's dealing with. We can't make a decision that's not based on the evidence before it. It can't come with a prior view and, irrespective of the evidence, make a decision. So there are all these checks and balances built into the relevant clause. And when the committee goes clause by clause, it may want to think, what's the rationale for it? This is the rationale, to make sure that we have those checks and balances. So it's not, in a democracy, one can't get to the point where we insulate processes from the electorate, from the people. I mean, ultimately, a democracy is about the people. And if the people have points of view, they raise those, and the executive has to play that role. What we've done is we've said, we don't give the executive the power to impose a remedy. We give the executive simply the power to say, have a market inquiry. Let the facts be known. Give everybody an opportunity to bring the facts. I'm sure honorable members will find that that is the mildest power that one could consider an executive to have. And in fact, there are people, including in the ruling party, who feel that that is perhaps too weak an expression, that an executive should have greater powers. And I can understand the argument, but we're trying to find a balanced approach that markets and citizens can see. We're trying to marry transformation objectives, and we're trying to do it in a responsible way, that we grow the economy and we send signals that this is a well-governed economy. On the question of exemptions, they're also quite an interesting story. So at the moment, in the current Act, the Minister of Economic Development has a specific role in exemptions. It's already there. So the Minister may designate a sector based on the economic stability of a sector. What we've done with that provision is we've made it clear it's not only when a sector is in terminal decline or when it is going through difficulty that it may be designated. Now, let me take a step backwards first. What is designation? So, even bigger, let me deal with the exemption clauses, Clause 10 of the Act. Clause 10 is quite an important clause because it says, under what circumstance do you allow firms to collaborate with each other? In other words, to break the law. Because you've got to have a provision that entitles firms to break the law legally. I'm using a concept that I'm just doing it for effect. But to do things that the law would otherwise not allow, if there are good reasons to do so. That's what any exemption provision in any law is ultimately about. It's to allow you to do things that the law otherwise would not allow you to do. So currently, the competition authorities can make a decision based on two things. A criteria that's set out clearly in the law, or through a sector that is designated by the minister. Now, we had a very interesting example recently. In fact, not recently, preceded my time. In the run-up to the World Cup, 2010 World Cup, the petroleum industry made an application for an exemption from the Competition Act to enable them to share their infrastructure, their oil pipelines, and to coordinate when one refinery will shut down for maintenance so that you don't have the unintended consequence. They may all shut down at the same time and you don't have fuel in the economy. Now, normally this would not be permitted. So they came up. And the problem was the competition authorities didn't have grounds to grant that. It was then went to the minister, and the minister then designated the sector. And they designated it on the word in the Act called the stability of the sector. Now, an argument could be made, it's not really a stability issue. Argument can be made, it is a stability issue. And you're in the hands of the courts. So we've now clarified that a little bit. It's for both growth of an industry as well as stability and transformation of an industry. That's one change. The more significant change, and the one that I suspect on the Bocado you may be referring to, is a change in Section 10, subsection 10 of the bill. And that's a new provision. And it's a very interesting provision, and it's one that the business community at NEDLAC were actually quite keen on. And what it says is that the minister may, after consultation with the Competition Commission, and in order to give effect to the purposes of this Act as set out in Section 2, issue regulations in terms of Section 78, exempting an agreement or practice or category of agreements or practices from the application of this chapter. Basically, what does that mean? Now, to fully understand that, I need to just jump a little bit to the exemption arrangements in our law. At the moment, a firm comes to the commission and it says, we seek to do the following, can we get an exemption? The commission then does a full inquiry into it and eventually it makes a decision, yes or no. In the European Union, they've got an interesting concept called a block exemption, where effectively through their regulations, they identify certain kinds of agreements or practices that gets virtually an automatic exemption. An example, and if honourable members were wanting to ask what kind of things do we have in mind. Yeah, I'll give two or three examples. We may decide from a policymaker's point of view that we want to encourage small businesses to bring down the prices that they pay. Say all the spaza shops, honourable, follow the question you asked. If we wanted all the spaza shops to go to baked beans factories and say, give us cheaper prices. You charge ShopRite checkers very little for your baked beans. You charge us a lot for your baked beans or bread. They can't at the moment come together and combine and go to the bakery and say we want cheaper bread. So we may be able to issue a regulation that says any combination by competitors who are small businesses and who collectively have less than 10% of the market share, 15% of the market share, that is directed towards reducing input costs will be permitted. So something like that. Obviously, I'm not writing it in the language of the regulation. Now, if that is issued, it means that those small companies go to the Competition Commission. They simply say to the Commission, this is who we are, this is the market share we have, and the Commission has to virtually automatically grant them the exemption. Okay. Now, why is that necessary? It's necessary because there are whole categories of agreements that serves the public interest, that is consistent with the objects of the Act. For example, one of the objects of the Act is the promotion of small business. Here's another example. If we were to run a national campaign to promote a buy local campaign, and we wanted to bring firms together to collaborate to promote local procurement, we wanted the retailers to do so. Retailers will say to us, but we can't get together to see how we can support local business because that would be contrary to the Competition Act. Because if we coordinate in where we buy, then that would be against the law. So yeah, government could be running this campaign, the whole society could be supporting it, all parties in parliament could support it, but technically it's in breach of the law. The Competition Commission doesn't have grounds in the law to exempt something like that. So you can issue the equivalent of a block exemption like that. Now, why not give that power to the Competition Commission? Because they can't issue regulations, so that's the one legal challenge. It's regulations that are issued by ministers. But more profoundly, rather than just the legal constraint, regulators are not policymakers. The policymaker must take responsibility for policy, must make it transparently and openly, and regulators implement that. They look at the facts and ensure that the facts and the law are connected, but the decision whether one would exempt a buy local campaign, whether you exempt a whole category of small business, is ultimately a policy decision. So it's not a decision you can, in fact, or that you ought, in fact, to subcontract to a regulator. So on the exemptions, business was keen on this because they saw this chapter as providing a few different entry points. Labor, organized labor, were also very supportive of it. And in fact, the concept arose from the discussion, the concerns that business raised in the NEDLAC process, that the law is too rigid at the moment. Now, ideally for business, they would have liked the law to say once this regulation has been issued, then the companies are automatically exempted. The competition authorities were worried. They said, look, if you do that, companies may well abuse it and collude with each other. And when they are caught, they said, no, we thought we were doing it in consistent with the regulation. So what we've done here is we said the minister issues it, but the company's concerned still has to go to the commission, lodge the information with the commission. The commission does a cursory check that the facts are appropriate, and then automatically grants the exemption. So in fact, this is one of the areas of flexibility we've introduced in the law. Is the issuing of regulations by the minister new? No. Section 78 already gives the minister that power of the current act. In fact, some lawyers have argued that you can read into 78 that the minister already has this power that we put into 1010. It's just not clear, and you always have the danger that the courts could find otherwise. So this makes explicit that policymakers have the power to issue these, what we call, block exemptions. Finally, the question of appeals. And I suspect that Honorable Cardo is referring to the fact that the Minister of Economic Development now has the right of appeal against the decision of a competition tribunal in a merger. And the question is it appropriate? What's the rationale? What's the reason for it? And is this executive overreach? So to answer that, I need to go back to what does the existing law say. So the existing law gives the minister a responsibility on public interest. So the minister, when a merger comes up, the minister doesn't block the merger. The minister's role is to try to identify what are public interest concerns. So remember, the minister in the government system represents the view of the executive and through that the government of the day. So in a case like today where unemployment levels are high, a minister or a government would put a higher value to employment. Should, in a number of years from now, unemployment levels be very low, ministers at the time may put greater value on something else in the public interest, small business development or export performance or something. Those are matters that are policy judgments. The law provides you the categories, and then you've got to weigh up the policy considerations. So what the minister is entitled to do is the minister gets the information from the commission when the filing is done. The minister is then entitled to engage the Competition Commission on the matter. The minister can then also, so then the commission makes a recommendation to the tribunal. If the minister supports the recommendation, the minister can go to the tribunal and participate. In other words, appoint advocates and lawyers and economists and others to put the government evidence and information on the table. If the commission makes a recommendation that the minister does not agree with, as we had some examples, the minister is entitled to go to the tribunal and argue against it, provide the evidence through the lawyers and so on. The tribunal then makes a decision. Now, the minister doesn't alone have this power. So too does a firm that's affected. So too does a competitor firm. So too does a trade union. Once the tribunal makes a decision, something very interesting happens. The firm concerned can take the decision to the Competition Appeal Court. A competitor can take it to the Competition Appeal Court. A trade union can take it to a Competition Appeal Court. The executive can't. But once it comes up at the Competition Appeal Court, then the executive is entitled to participate. So it's what we call a lacuna, a gap in the law. It's not clearly, could not have been intended that the public representatives are not entitled to take a matter to the Competition Appeal Court. So we're simply plugging that. There's broad agreement by the social partners that it's necessary, but they made interesting points. So we published this in December, and in the process of engaging business and labor, different points came up. And We then refined the clauses that are put for in the final bill that is before Parliament. The first change we made is we said that the minister can appeal only if the minister participated in the proceedings at the tribunal or the competition commission. So in other words, the minister can't sit back, let the processes run, and then just decide right in there, okay, I don't like it, let me appeal. And secondly, the minister's appeal is specifically limited to public interest issues. So it is on the areas that the law already gives the minister the power to intervene. Of course, by special application to the Competition Appeal Court, the minister could put that forward, even if he or she didn't participate, make an argument why it should be heard, but of course you're in the hands of the court. So what the bill provides for is specifically public interest, right, to appeal public interest, and only where the minister has participated. Those seem to me to be very sensible refinements to the original proposal, which was going to give the minister broad powers to appeal. And I thought one needs to constrain it a little bit so that the system works well and that you don't have unintended consequences. So I had then proposed to Cabinet that we make that change to the bill. So the appeal is fairly narrow and appropriate. Absent that, you're really saying that the government of the day would not have the right to appeal a decision of the Competition Tribunal, which would be anomalous. The next area that Honourable Cardo raises is the market inquiries. And there are two questions there. The first question is the binding nature of the decisions that the market inquiry makes. Now, this is an interesting one, and we spend a fair bit of time thinking through this. In the panel gave it much thought last year when they advised me, and in the process of discussion with business and labour, there's been quite a lengthy discussion on this one. In our current law, you can have a market inquiry, and all that the commission can do is make recommendations. It's got no original power to make any decision. And when it makes those recommendations, and those recommendations can be made to other regulators, to the minister, to, in a sense, any person, even to the firms, but they are purely recommendations. If we are going to deal with the challenge of economic structure, and we are going to try to find ways of opening up the economy, and if we are to go through a process of a fact-based inquiry, then that fact-based inquiry must have teeth. It must have the ability to make a decision that is binding on the parties. So we've provided for that. But we've provided for it with a few important qualifications. So the first qualification we've done is to say, if the market inquiry should find that a market is so concentrated that the only way out is to break up a firm, what is called divestiture, then it must not have that power. It can only make that as a recommendation to the Competition Tribunal. The Tribunal already have provisions dealing with divestiture in the current Act. So that's a matter that the market inquiry must make as a recommendation to the Tribunal. Secondly, we put in a provision that says that any decision or any action that the Commission makes must be connected to the evidence that was before it, and it must be proportional. In other words, it must be the minimum action to achieve what you're seeking to do. If there are two options, one is a mild option and the other one is a more drastic option, the Commission will have to take the milder option if the milder option can achieve the outcome that is intended. So we're constraining the Commission through the market inquiry quite tightly on that. The Next thing that we've done is we've said, once the committee market inquiry through the commission has made a decision, any firm that's adversely affected by the decision can take the matter on appeal to the competition tribunal, and from there to the competition appeal court. So in other words, we've provided the checks and balances that if the market inquiry and the commission gets it wrong, then there is appealability. You're capable of taking the matter on appeal, and we haven't put intrusive requirements in the act. All you need to show is that there's an adverse effect, and then you can take it. So it's either that, or what makes in the law, you prescribe the actions. In other words, you say no company could have more than X market share. In other words, you have a legislative prohibition on concentration. That's really the two. Either you have effective instrument in a market inquiry, or the law itself deals with it actively. It's very rigid if the law does it. It has unintended consequences, and frankly, from our point of view, from an economic policy point of view, there are many instances where a level of concentration is unavoidable, and where either through technology factors or economies of scale, you can't actually deconcentrate the market. So it's that balancing act and that evidence-led approach that is for us the heart of it. That brings me to the what Honorable Cardo refers to as the orange card. We refer to it as the yellow card. So in soccer, when you do a foul, you get a yellow card. And when you do a second foul, you get a red card. And when you get a red card, you're out. Now, that's the analogy. In our law, when we drafted the law in 1998, we did something quite unusual. We put in what we call colloquially a yellow card. You won't find the word yellow card in anywhere in the Act. But we said certain prohibited practices, if you found guilty of it, you would not get any penalty. Penalties would only come in if you were found guilty, if the same firm was found guilty a second time of the same offense. Okay. Now, the question is, why was that put into the law in 1998? It was put in because we were, for the first time, introducing the modern system of competition, the prohibited practices with clear penalties. The whole system was really, in a sense, a completely new system. And at the time, firms and others were concerned that because it's new in South Africa, and because they're not sure what it will mean, they requested that certain kinds of offenses, the lawyers call it the rule of reason offenses, should not immediately attract a penalty. And it was agreed at the time. But today, when we look at it, there is no other major competition jurisdiction anywhere in the world that has, to our knowledge, a yellow card regime. In our own law, whether it's tax law or any other law, we don't have yellow cards. If you break the law, you are subject to penalties, and the courts decide how the extent of the penalties, what are the mitigating factors, what are the aggravating factors. Do you get a relatively small penalty because genuinely you could not have anticipated or no harm was done, or do you get the maximum penalty because your actions led to significant negative outcomes. That's what the judicial process is about, is to balance and weigh that. So it's very unusual to have something that says if you do the wrong thing first time, you only get not even a warning, you let off, and it's only if you do it the second time that you get a penalty. But the other side of it is, it acts to chill the commission's investigations, because the commission now looks at its budget, it looks at its person power, and it says, we think this firm is guilty of this problem, But in allocating our budget, there's no point in putting any money in yet. It will take us 3-4 years to do the investigation. It will cost us many millions because competition investigations are very expensive because you've got to have lawyers, economists, investigators, and so on. Even if we can show that the firm is guilty of the offense, it has no consequence. The only consequence is an implicit warning to say, you're guilty of this offense, you mustn't do it again. So it means that many of these offenses that are covered by the so-called yellow card are actually not dealt with by the competition authorities because they say, you know, in the hierarchy of things, nothing comes of it. And one wants to stamp out prohibited practices. That's the point. When Parliament says this is a prohibited practice, then the regulators must ensure that it's stamped out. So there is no, we're bringing our law in line with international precedent. We're bringing competition law in line with general laws, tax laws, all other laws that we have. And we're ensuring that the prohibited practices are properly prosecuted. Now the question could be, now do firms always know what the offences are? So what we've done is we've said we'll follow the international example and issue guidelines. So the Commission will publish guidelines. And those guidelines, there's now a statutory requirement on them to publish the guidelines. Those guidelines will give a greater indication of the kind of conduct that would be permitted or not permitted in these areas that are set out. So that's why the yellow card has been removed. We also provide in the penalty section that the courts can take into account whether there are guidelines. So if a firm says, look, genuinely, this is one of those on-the-edge things where no one could really have anticipated. We now see we were wrong, but we could not have. They can make that argument in court, and they can say there isn't a guideline in place. Honourable Cardo mentioned Section 8 on the definition of excessive pricing and Section 9 on price discrimination, but I did not get the detail of it. And if we can be favoured with the detail, I would be happy to respond to those any concerns that there may be, to at least provide the rationale why we went the direction that we went. So, Chairperson, I think I've covered the questions that have come up. Taken a bit of time, and I've done so because I know the committee will be having to reflect on these matters in due course. So I've gone a little bit deeper than just the questions, in the hope that it may provide the committee with additional information on how we came into this. This bill, we've spent quite a bit of time on it, so in many cases we look at different options. The option that we felt was the most appropriate one is the one that comes into the bill. In a number of cases, these options were significantly influenced by the parties at NEDLAC, and perhaps later, before the session ends, I could just make a short remark on the NEDLAC process. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Minister. I think it was necessary that you go that length in your responses. Dr. Kliani, you want to make, and Mem Fulo.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. We think that it is appropriate that we should express our appreciation for the extra mile that the Minister has taken in trying to explicate this intricate and very complex process. But earlier on, Chairperson, you said something very important. You said this is a process. There's still going to be lots and lots of engagement. And every time we come together with the executive, as we go back, we'll be doing a lot of homework and so on, because we'll be asking the questions, we'll be probing and so on, to make sure that in the final analysis, we have a beautiful piece of legislation. Now, Chairperson, as legislators, obviously, one of our key areas is that of oversight over the playing, you know, making the executive to account. That is key. But I think it should also not be confused to be some kind of a thrust or a desire on our part to strive for the elimination, complete elimination of the role of the executive. It would be very wrong to take it to those extremes, because we are aware as legislators that by and large, to a very large extent, our democratic dispensation is premised, amongst others, on the tenets of the trias politique, the tripartite separation of state authority into, you know, those three authorities that we know of, the executive, the judiciary, and the legislative. So it is interesting to know, Mr. Chairperson, that the amendment bill, under normal circumstances, could have provided the executive with an opportunity to go for the jugular, to make sure that it has all those powers and so on. But what we are seeing in this amendment bill is actually an attempt to try and create space for other voices to be heard before any final decision can be taken. I think that also needs to be appreciated. This is a mixture, you know, of different ingredients and so on, but it's important for this different ingredients to blend in nicely to give us the kind of product that our country requires. So we agree with you, Chairperson, that indeed will be part of this process until we arrive at a conclusion. And we are aware that our system is such that even when the process has been completed, there will still be ample space to can raise issues which may lead to another amendment being there. So I'm just saying in a nutshell, and I think I'll be representing many other legislators here, that we are happy with what is going on at the moment, and the manner in which you are also leading us, Chairperson. We believe that at the end of the day, we shall be able to make an impact on the lives of our people. I thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Sliani, for those words. Ma'am Fulo, Chair, I just need some clarity on block exemptions. The minister says there will be time for block. My question is, how long? Is it going to be block exemptions for long, or is there time frame? And then also on this block exemption, are we planning or already there thinking about having some guidelines so that not every big terminal can come and say, I need exemption? When do you apply for that kind of exemption? Thank you.
Thank you, Ma'am Fulo. Any other? No. Okay. Minister, if you want to come.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. So thank you very much, Honourable Kiani, for the warm words that you've shared. I think on Honourable Mfolo's question, the best way to put it is to say that it will depend. So let me give two examples. When the minister designates a sector, so this is not a block exemption, this is a designation provision, the minister always specifies the period for which the designation is in place, because that covers an entire sector, and it then enables the competition authorities to do something specific. In the case of block exemptions, when the regulations are published, they're likely to enable certain categories of exemptions to be for a lengthy period of time. So I would say provisions dealing with small business where you enable small businesses to do certain things together because they have limited market power. Remember, we're always trying to protect the abuse of market power. That's the key. That's the heart of competition. Because you don't have huge market power among small players, you can give them a much longer latitude to engage in the specified actions. But if you're trying to push hard for, let's say, a new technology, say if we want competitors to co-fund a new technology, and more we may have to get South African firms to do that in the fourth industrial revolution, because those technologies cross competitors, it even cross industries. That may be for a limited period. So it's hard ahead of time to identify the length of it. It's a valid question, it's an important concern, but it could be in the public interest that these be quite lengthy exemptions, or it could be in the public interest that it be for a specified shorter period of time. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Minister, for the responses, and I'm taking that members have gone through the amendments. And just want to say that perhaps we really need to remind ourselves that these are amendments, you know, to an existing law. You know, they are not standalone. Then this is not a new thing that comes from nowhere. This comes from lengthy experience of through implementation that a need was seen to really amend or make changes so that we can better serve our people, because this is in the interest of the country. I know during this process of amendments, as legislators, we're going to be lobbied from all sectors, interested parties, and I would like to appeal to all of us to try and resist that. Try to be as objective as possible. Because all what we are doing it for the interest of our own country and our own people. And in whatever we're doing, that should be at the back of our minds. Because yes, you'll be lobbied and be given whatever you are given. At the end of the day, it's going to compromise our people's livelihoods and our country's performance in trying to make, you know, our lives better. So it's very important that we consider that. But please, let's go back, read the amendment bill, go back, remind ourselves of what the current legislation says, and then compare if it's bettering or not bettering. We then cut back. We will be releasing or distributing the submissions so that members can go through that, so that we come back. As we come back, we then discuss. There will be a time for discussions by members where the minister and other people won't be there. It's only ourselves looking at all what people are saying or interested parties are saying, including, of course, everyone else, whether inside or outside. The New American Bar Association is also interested in this. So we look at that, their submission, whether it's serving our country or not serving our country. And then we make our own recommendations outside any form of influence, whether from the executive or from whoever else. And then we submit that. That's our role as legislators, to make laws and amend laws. It's our role. So we will be doing that without any form of influence. I will appeal that we do so. Thank you so much. In the absence of any further questions or comments, may I then... before I thank the minister, I saw your hand, minister. Can I give it to you?
Chair, thank you very much. I just wanted to make one remark on NEDLAC, because you had referred to the NEDLAC process at the start, and I felt after the questions were put, it may be appropriate. So if you're happy that I do so now.
Yes.
Thank you. So what we did was we published the bill last year. In December, we received public comments, which we went through, but we also had a interesting process through NEDLAC, where we sat down with two key parties that would have essentially key interests in these matters, which is the business community and the organized labor sector. And in the course of the discussions, we engaged very, very substantially with them. At the end of the discussions, having enriched the discussions, but also finding careful balancing between parties, we then signed off on the bill. And in many cases, and the honourable members will in a number of cases see in the formulation of the provision that they seem to be either in the provision itself balancing different interests, or in one provision it would be making a point, but in another provision it seeks to balance that point. So a lot of it has been to try to find a reasonable balance between different interests, because when we talk to business, first, business itself represents many different sectors. It represents larger businesses with dominant firms who may be concerned about what the legal framework will be for dominant firms. But it also supports or represents smaller businesses who may benefit from the opportunities that come out. There are the balancing act between business and labor in any of these matters. Mergers, for example, deeply affect labor. So we've had to take all of those careful balancing things. And all of the parties recognize that we were not going to be, it's not possible in a bill of this nature to come out with a package that one constituency will feel ecstatic about, because it means the other constituencies will be deeply unhappy with it. So it's been to try to find a balance. And it's a very careful balance that we've attempted to strike. And at the end of the discussion, the NEDLAC parties adopted a report that had a paragraph that I just wanted to read to the committee. The paragraph says, the parties at NEDLAC recognized that the process of engagement had been meaningful, substantial, and helpful, and that the Competition Amendment Bill 2018 represents a package of provisions which constitutes an appropriate and effective balance of the interests of all the social partners and the policy imperatives of government. The parties have agreed to actively promote the objectives of the bill. So that's the quote I wanted to give, because I think they recognize at the end that in trying to find that balance, we must also look at what South Africa needs, and that we've attempted to try to do this. So it is quite an unusual outcome that you have parties that would otherwise have widely divergent views that feel that through a process of engagement, those views are acknowledged in a number of cases, incorporated in an appropriate way, maybe not first prize, but second prize, in some cases first prize, and that ultimately what they walk away from is what they call an appropriate and effective balance between these interests. So to the extent that we as the executive can be of any help to the committee in its deliberations, in providing the rationale for the changes, what the trade-offs were between the different interest groups that we had to seek to balance, we're at your disposal, Chairperson, to you and to the members of the committee, and our door would be open for it. So thank you very much for the opportunity explicate, to elaborate and to explain a little bit the reasons for the amendments we've put up. Thank you very much.
Thanks to you too, Minister, and the team. I know that you spent sleepless nights developing this particular piece of legislation. Thank you so much for your commitment and dedication to the process. We will indeed invite you where we feel really we need your intervention, and we appreciate also that you're offering such. Thank you so much. Members, I guess this then marks the end of this particular meeting. We will meet again on Tuesday, yes, the 28th, and I think it's going to be for 2 days, 28th and 29th, where we're going to be listening to oral submissions. But I would also propose that we meet earlier that day so that we can get our legal advisor. I'm going to engage our legal advisor a lot in this process, so that before every meeting we then get advice on the procedural matters, because we don't want to we don't want to falter in any way. Otherwise, thank you so much, and the meeting stands as adjourned. Oh, sorry, there's fresh water there for tea. Those who have an appetite for more coffee or tea.
I think that's the right approach. I mean, really, I thought that you know you said to the
dedication. I mean, I was flying the wall in the beginning and then very active in the sort of late negotiation, and I can say a lot of time and energy. You know, that Ned and I, he distilled it down to one paragraph, but it was probably, oh gosh, I mean, 20, 30 hours of negotiation in different settings. Yeah, very good. I'm going to tell the media as well. No, Chuck.